This episode is brought to you by Big Green Egg, the world's largest producer of ceramic charcoal grills, and also by Springer Mountain Farms, over 300 family farms raising birds in Georgia's Blue Ridge Mountains. Learn more at biggreenegg.com and springermountainfarms.com.
Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network at Charleston Wine and Food Festival. We want to give a big shout out once again to our sponsors, Big Green Egg and Springer Mountain Farms. Thank you so much for letting us be here. So we're now back with Tamina Momtazi and Ian. Can you help me, Ian?
Perkayasta.
Thank you.
No worries.
So first of all, can I get you guys to both explain a little bit about your background and what you do?
I'll let you go first.
Okay. My name is Ian Perkayasta, and I own Regalis Foods in New York. I essentially procure hard-to-find ingredients from around the world, mainly truffles, caviar, different mushrooms, and foraged edibles. And I sell to just find any restaurants across the country. Yeah.
You made me so hungry. So I am the winemaker at Mesa Winery out of McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. So pretty much I'm responsible for all the daily processes of bottling, picking, any decision of the wine I have to do. His job sounds more fun, like going selling stuff. I just try to make wine.
That's pretty cool, too.
They both sound extremely fun.
That's very true. So you guys are both fairly young in your industries, probably some of the youngest in each. Who do you credit your drive at such a young age to?
So when I started this job, it was actually 10 years ago. July 30th is my 10-year anniversary, and I'm hoping my parents get me cake. That's the only thing I want, is my anniversary gift to be a cake. But I was 24, and I was kind of fresh out of school, worked for a couple wineries. And that time, my father, he had a winemaker. He's never been in the cellar. So he calls me when I was living in New Zealand and saying, please come home and make wine for us. So my biggest inspiration is actually my parents. And it's really teary because my parents came in this country when they were escaped from Iran. So they left in a revolution time, came to a country that my mom did not speak this language at all, English. She knew a couple words. And my father went to University of Texas, so he knew how to speak English. So seeing them to become who they are my inspiration of every day.
That's pretty hard to beat. My dad also went to the University of Texas. My dad, yeah. In terms of my inspiration as well, I think I've been very fortunate to have been part of a family that has always, you know, given us so much inspiration. My father is an Indian immigrant. And my mother is white bread Texan, and I started foraging for mushrooms when I was 15 in Arkansas. My family, during the recession, relocated from Houston, Texas, where we were living this kind of affluent lifestyle, to rural Arkansas in pursuit of a simpler life. And that's when I started spending a lot of time in the woods and eventually learning how to forage for wild mushrooms. And that's kind of like what jump-started this career of dealing mushrooms and foraged edibles. I would go around to local restaurants and cold call my different wares. And then eventually I moved to New York, and my parents didn't make me go to college, so it was great. I forewent college, and, you know, again, like, I'm just super lucky to be a part of a family that's allowed me to, you know, to explore my passions and to really, you know, pursue this life. So, yeah.
Did you have foraging mentors who taught you plant and mushroom identification?
Yeah, so when I moved to Arkansas, my uncle and his family were living locally, and my uncle is an avid outdoorsman, and he was, the inspiration, the guy who showed me how to forage for morels and chanterelles and black trumpets early on. And that's really where I learned all of my foraging abilities from. And then I've always enjoyed cooking and eating good food ever since I can remember. So I've always loved food. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think I read somewhere that when you were really young, your parents actually would, like, help you by, like, going to the airport and helping you pick up shipments. Is that true?
Yeah, so I would basically make calls in between classes in high school, and I would go to the airport after school a few days a week, and my parents would take turns driving me around to local restaurants in a tri-state area to cold call product. So, yeah, there was a lot of help on their end.
Yeah, so you really were working really closely with your parents for a
long
time.
Well, I mean, not super closely, but, I mean, they would definitely chauffeur me around to different restaurants.
Yeah.
I think that was the extent of their involvement. But, I mean, they're entrepreneurs themselves. I mean, they started a leather manufacturing company out of India 25 years ago. And so I think this, like, entrepreneurial spirit was always, like, so prevalent in our house. I mean, they were, you know, they had a home office. They did all their work at the house. So, I mean, I think growing up, I was just accustomed to that lifestyle, which is what I've built for myself today.
Yeah. And Tamina, you work with your family today. I mean, still.
Yeah.
What is that like? Like, would you recommend that to other people?
I think you have to have a really good, special bond with your family, because you have to have a thick skin, because your biggest critic is your parents and your boss. So therefore, sometimes I feel that there's good days and bad days, like any other job, but they make me a better person, and actually the whole entire family does. So if my sisters say something to me, like trying to criticize me, they're trying to make me better. So, like, I do that to them every day too, saying, don't do that.
And you were saying that, you were telling me a story about how your dad was, like, critiquing the wine you were making. Can you tell us about that?
So my biggest critic is actually my father. And my mother is, like, they played bad cop, good cop. And so when he's, like, really hard on me, so, like, one harvest, my birthday falls on harvest. So I try to claim a national holiday, but the grapes never listen to me. So... I try. But so one year, it was a very light vintage. It was a 10 and 11. It was a kind of cooler vintage. And I'm doing my pump overs in the winery. And my dad comes in to me, and he likes really big Pinots. And I'm really more true style Pinots. And I'm, like, being very gentle on my wines. And he's like, this is terrible color. And I'm looked at him, and I'm, like, about to burst in tears. And I'm like, not today. This is my birthday. And there was another winemaker, because I was going to borrow some equipment, and she heard that, and she was like, leave her alone. She's making Pinot Noir. If you want her to make Syrah, move to a different place. But he's my biggest critic, so I love him for it every day.
Yeah, but I'm sure he's also your biggest fan, too.
Yeah. I would say sometimes he's my good cheerleader when he wants to be.
Yeah.
Did you have additional mentors in the winemaking industry?
Yes, but it wasn't like mentors, like in a sense of like I would go and ask questions. It was wine. Like any wine that I've ever had when I was like younger, I'm not saying under 21, but when I was young. But when I tasted it, that's what I was like, this is what kind of style that I would love to do. And then I would, you know, check them out year to year. And sometimes they were up and down, like any life. You know, you have good times, you have bad times. And they, I would say those were my mentors, were wine. So I wouldn't say like there was a one person per se.
Can you tell us about a wine or two that gave you an aha moment?
Yeah, so... in 2012, it was like in November, this Wine Spectator came out their top 100, and my dad just came out of a surgery and out of a heart. He had a really strange heart, not transplant, but he had a heart surgery. And I started getting text messages from random numbers, and I'm like, congratulations, congratulations. I'm like, what are you congratulating me? I'm not engaged. I'm not having a baby. What the hell are you congratulating? It's me. And one of the winemakers that I love and I adore he texted me, and then another female winemaker that I adore too, she texted me and said, congrats on the top 114, being top 100, being number 14. Wow. That was like my aha moment. It's like, finally, I made it. Thank wow. God.
Yeah. Ian, what was your aha moment in your foraging business?
I mean, definitely like the first time I ever tasted a truffle, like when I was 15, I was visiting friends in Houston and they invited me out to dinner and they were like, you know, Ian, order anything on the menu. And so I had always been obsessed with mushrooms, obviously, and I had never tasted a truffle. And I ordered this black truffle ravioli dish with the foie gras sauce. And that was like really what changed it all for me. And that's like when I became totally seduced by the truffle. And that's kind of what started me on this path to, you know, discovering this underground world of truffles and mushrooms and different things.
And how young were you when you knew you wanted to move to New York? And what was that transition like? Because you basically moved your business.
So I had a small company in Arkansas, and then I was approached by an Italian company that was looking for U.S. representation, and so I basically built a U.S. subsidiary for that company, and with the money that they had made my senior year of high school, they opened an office for me in Newark, New Jersey, and so after high school, I basically moved to New Jersey because I couldn't afford living in the city, and I had this very bleak office in Newark, and I got, you know, the shit kicked out of me my third day. I like had a suitcase full of truffles I was rolling on the street, and I got jumped by six guys.
Oh, literally.
And yeah, for the next like 3 years it was super depressing and bleak, and then eventually I left and started my new current company, Regalis, which is now 5 years old. So it's definitely been a wild ride.
Wow.
And you have a book coming out, or it just came out.
My book, yeah. So I have a book called Truffle Boy that just came out 2 weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. About just my life in this crazy underground world of procuring and providing specialty products to different restaurants.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
And Tamina, what new projects do you have coming down the line?
I have three new projects that are coming out, and I can't say any of the names of the labels yet, but I'm really excited to work on those because it's going to be a little bit different than my typical style of what I make in the cellar.
Mm-hmm. Top secret projects.
Yeah.
The CIA is finding, like, you know, they contacted me.
It's very hush-hush.
And what do you guys have on the docket for Charleston this weekend?
So I have an event tonight from the Ashes, and tomorrow everyone keeps telling me I have a busy day, but I feel I have a Pinot Envy, and then I have a wine dinner at Zero George. Mm-hmm. Really excited about that. And then if I might have another surprise, I don't know, but they keep telling me I'm really busy tomorrow.
You are full of top secret projects.
Yeah.
If somebody wanted to go down your path and have an exciting career of secret surprise weekend events and winemaking, what advice would you give for somebody who is looking to start out and break into the industry?
So I have a formal education of beer master and winemaking, so I went that route. So I would say the first thing is go to school. It's really important because in my career, chemistry is big. You have to know everything on the sense of the lab side. If you want to go like live your life like the fullest, you want to skip that stuff, go work wineries and work from the bottom and work to the top. So those are two scenarios I can give you, but I honestly, learning lab is really important because that's where I found my passion was lab work, because I was like, oh, I'm a mad scientist. But other people might not feel that thinking they're making art, but I would say those two routes are great. And maybe I love living my life like a surprise, because I feel like if I'm well prepared, then everything's going to be so boring, or I'd be so stressed that nothing's going my way. And that's the route I would tell you. If you're a type A person, go that way. Type B, go this way.
I like the fork path. Thanks for offering some options.
Yeah.
Ian, what about you? If somebody wanted to break into foraging, how would they start?
I try to encourage as many people as I can to just pick up a field guide and walk into the woods and see what nature has to offer, because there's so many wild plants and edible greens in the forest that are so common to identify and are delicious, and just to follow your dreams and make it all happen. I mean, I would say, I don't want to conflict with what you're saying, but about the whole education thing, but like realize that there's other paths to an education, and to find like that one thing that really, you know, is illuminating in your life, and to just chase it, and to realize it's okay, and that you're going to make like a shitload of mistakes, and that, it takes those mistakes to become successful.
I agree with that 100%, because your failures are your most successful moments in your life, because you learn about it.
Totally.
So I agree with that.
Is there a specific guidebook you recommend for beginner foragers? And I'm sure that depends on the region, but say for the New York, New England region?
It definitely like depends on the region. I would go to like your local bookstore and just pick up a local regional guide. But obviously like with mushrooms and with greens, there's like a lot of crossover from state to state. So even online, you can download foraging pamphlets on different greens and mushrooms. And chances are, you know, there's something growing in your backyard that is edible and delicious. And so, I find so many edible plants in Manhattan, like on the street, that are covered in like dog piss, but edible nonetheless. There are tons of things out there, and especially in your backyard that are edible. So
wow,
yeah.
Any super dangerous things people should be on the lookout for?
When I first started Regalis, we buy from like 75 different foragers, and I used to give foragers lists of product that we bought, and there was Angelica, wild Angelica, which is essentially like a wild rhubarb, and there was a forager that sent us a big box of Angelica, and it ended up being hemlock, which is a very, very poisonous look-alike plant, and so we just have to make sure that everything is like totally vetted before we sell it. It can be a tricky business to be in. We have a very high liability insurance policy to protect us from those things. There was another time where we're selling these fruits called pawpaw, which is actually indigenous to North America, but it looks like a tropical fruit. It has like a banana, like kind of mango-like flavor, and it has a very goopy texture, like similar to like an avocado, like a very ripe avocado, and it grows here in Charleston all the way up the coast to New York, and the seeds are poisonous, and so we were selling some to a restaurant once, and they made a sorbet with everything, and they didn't heed my advice and remove the seeds, and so when they all ate it, everyone projectile vomited in the kitchen.
Oh, no.
And so that was like another kind of horror story in the business, but there are definitely some cool things growing up.
There's actually
woods.
A restaurant in Charleston called Pawpaw. I think the chef's going to come by
oh,
later.
Oh, very cool.
I actually didn't know that that's what that fruit was.
Yeah.
Now I will. I will know not to eat
the
seeds.
Thomas Jefferson's favorite fruit.
Oh, wow.
He had a grove in Monticello. So.
Oh, very cool.
Yes.
Very cool. Well,
what do you suppose Thomas Jefferson's favorite wine was?
You know, I actually thought about that, like, couple months ago about that. I kind of think it was a white wine, and if there was in Virginia Viognier, I think he would love that. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know why I don't think he was a red drinker. I know he made reds, but in my mind I think he loved whites, because one, it was in Virginia and it's hot and humid, so to cool off, that's what I was thinking in my head. But I know it sounds really weird, but...
It's an interesting theory. Yeah.
Refreshing.
Yeah.
I want to give you both a chance to give big ups to an organization or somebody in your community who's doing great work in the food space, whoever would like to start.
I'll let you go first.
I mean, there's a multitude of organizations that are changing or enabling a younger generation of eaters, and I really encourage like community gardens and everything that Alice Waters has done in, you know, bringing young people together and, you know, enabling young people to enjoy good quality food. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it's a weird dichotomy. I sell luxury foods, but yet it's kind of a strange position to be in. But I think eliminating child hunger is, you know, a very important thing, obviously. So I would say No Kid Hungry is a great organization.
Well, I mean, times are changing here in the world. So, I mean, there's a lot of organizations out and around us that are really good. But as you said, any company that is constantly thinking about their environment, I really give them shout out, because that's really important, because farming is the first basis of me making wine. So if we don't, you know, protect our farmers and about the whole climate changing and everything, we don't know what's going to happen. So that's those organizations, I give them a props to. Oh, yeah.
I was in FFA.
Yeah. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I was in 4-H as well.
Oh, we didn't have country. 4-H, but
oh, you
yeah.
didn't? Okay. I was in the BB, the BB Gun Club.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, man. Yeah. You grew up in Arkansas, so
I
can imagine.
I did.
Yeah.
So.
Very cool.
Not much to do.
Alabama, that's where I grew up, so I totally get it.
You could totally relate.
Absolutely. Right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, guys. This was
a really
awesome conversation.
All thank right. you so much.
Thank yeah. you. Thanks.
Thanks so right. much, Tamina Momtazi and Ian Perkayasta.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We will be back shortly.
All right. Once again, you're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit radio station based in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Check us out at heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks.
This episode is brought to you by Big Green Egg, the world's largest producer of ceramic charcoal grills. In business since 1974, they've transformed ancient cooking vessels into modern-day masterpieces. Today, they sell 7 sizes of the egg, as well as hundreds of accessories designed to make your cooking fun, entertaining, and delicious. Often copied but never equaled, the Big Green Egg is the ultimate cooking experience. Learn more at biggreenegg.com. This episode is also brought to you by Springer Mountain Farms, over 300 family farmers raising birds in Georgia's Blue Ridge Mountains. Many of them are second and even third generation. They're committed to doing things the right way. Springer was one of the first poultry companies to forego the use of antibiotics, and they've embraced other humane practices too. In fact, they were the first poultry company to earn the American Humane Association Seal of Approval. Learn more at springermountainfarms.com.